Good morning. I had a longer introduction planned. I was thinking of something around 25 hours and 10 minutes, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to cede most of my time to the next speaker. I just want to add that in these days, more than ever, I am totally convinced that we need art. We need truth the way only art can tell the truth. We need empathy, the way art can hold it. We need mystery, the way art can paint it. We need discovery, the way art invites our curiosity. And we need beauty, the way only art can frame it. We need light along with the shadows, inspiration along with the silence, and all the pauses in between. I met Bruce something like 30 years ago, I don't know the year, at a conference in Chicago called Following Christ. He was leading an arts track, and he prompted and prodded us to pursue and explore and listen and attempt, probe hard questions, and do the work. And over the years, I've seen and heard Bruce speak several times. I've stood before his moving and many-layered paintings. I've observed his generous spirit. I've digested and engaged with his thoughtful reflections. And I've also received his kind and prayerful friendship. Bruce himself knows loss and gain and light and shadow. He has a long list of accomplishments that are easy to find. And in his humility, he asked me not to have that be part of my introduction. But among other things, Bruce is a writer, a painter, a thinker, a pilgrim, a carpenter, a family man, and a friend. Welcome, Bruce. We're ready to receive the good words you bring.
Thanks, Barry. Thanks, brother. Good to be here again at Upper House. I love the lilt of that Upper House. It reminds me of Upper Room, which actually I'm going to get to. But before I start talking, I want to consult a couple of my two most favorite thinkers. This is my latest snow sculpture. Where? All of this. But you didn't do anything. Right. Art is dead. There's nothing left to say. Style is exhausted. Content is pointless. Art has no purpose. All that's left is commodity marketing. Consequently, I'm signing this landscape and you can own it for $1 million. Sorry, it doesn't match my furniture. So this morning I was listening to Anne Lamott. Maybe you know Bird by Bird and some of her, but there's an hour-long interview of her that's been recorded in the last couple of days. She's such a hoot. And she said, this morning she said, laughter is just carbonated holiness. So I love that. But the lilt of my talk this morning is actually a little more serious. I've entitled it Costly Simplicity, Seeking Beauty in a Wounded World. And that's because of my conviction that we are entering into, and are in fact in, a dark period in not just U.S. history, but global history. And this is a time for Christians to step up. If there was a time that we were made for, it's a time such as this. And the proof of that is the invitation that we got from Jesus to come to his table. And we know what his table involved, right? What makes this night coming tonight different from all nights, all other nights? Does anyone recognize that line? It's the beginning of Passover. It's spoken every Passover. What makes this night different from all other nights? And if you know the story of the Passover, it was a horrible night. Each of the Israelite families had to slay a precious animal and take the blood of that lamb and paint it over their doorpost so that the angel of destruction, which was coming, would pass over that household. And that angel of destruction came, and it took out the firstborn of all of Egypt, not just of humans, but of all animals, all life. I don't know what you think about this, but I'll just say I'm grateful that Jesus has invited me to his table. And he said that night at the so-called Last Supper, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. So what's interesting about this Last Supper that is so famous, this Da Vinci painting, is that we see in Jesus' face this melancholy, this sadness, because that Passover is not going to pass over him. That angel of death is coming for him. And after this, he went into the garden and prayed that the cup would pass his lips, that he wouldn't have to drink from it. But he said, "Nevertheless, thy will, O Lord, be done, not mine." So I want to start today with some initial questions. Is art or beauty a luxury mostly enjoyed in safe, affluent times, happy times? Is it irrelevant or inaccessible during a politically charged or war-torn time, a darkening time? Is it unavailable? Hear this. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. From Isaiah 53, the famous suffering servant passage. This figure is the central figure in a large altarpiece in near Colmar, France. The Eisenheim altarpiece painted by Grunewald in the early 16th century for a hospital that was a quarantine hospital, was set up for people who were suffering from something called St. Anthony's disease, which was thought to be highly contagious, like the pandemic like that we just lived through recently, only worse, because the symptoms were high fevers, gangrene, loss of limbs, legs, arms, noses, almost like leprosy, only worse because it came on fast and was thought to be extremely contagious. And so there was a hospital set up in a monastery for these sufferers of St. Anthony's disease. And Grunewald painted this altarpiece for the chapel of that hospital. And he deliberately made Jesus gruesome. I mean, truly gruesome. Ghastly greenish tinge to the flesh, thorns sticking out, his lips dried, and, you know, it's just a horrific-looking image. He deliberately made it ugly so that the people who felt ugly inside of that hospital realized that Jesus was one of them. Quarantined, having lost their faces disfigured, having lost arms or legs. Here's the interesting thing about this painting. Can we dim the light somehow? There's a detail of this slide that has to be seen in the dark. Okay, so look at either screen, but look at this seam right here. It goes up right through Jesus' arm. It's part of the altarpiece that's the central panel altarpiece of the crucifixion. The altarpiece opens up and it cuts off Jesus' right arm. And this is what you see when you cut off his arm. You see a jewel-like, beautiful interior with, on the left-hand side, the Annunciation, the angel Gabriel coming to Mary. In the middle, you see the Nativity. And on the right-hand side, you see the resurrection of Jesus. Below a constant is the entombment. So here's what the whole thing looks like, and it's now in the Unterlinden Museum. But my reason for sharing, starting off with this gruesome-looking crucifixion, is that much of the world's greatest art, music, poetry, is made in unfavorable circumstances. It's made during war, during outbreaks of disease, hunger, poverty, mental distress, emotional suffering. So if you have any question about whether beauty is relevant in a time such as ours, well, I think we know the answer to this question. Here's some examples. Olivier Messiaen wrote Quatuor pour la fin du temps, the famous quartet for the end of time, in a concentration camp. He was an inmate, along with Henri Okoka, Olivier, you know, Etienne Pasquier, Le Boulier. These were all famous musicians. He was a famous composer already when he was interred in this camp outside of Paris. And the guards must have known who he was because they smuggled in staff paper for writing music and a little pencil stub that he got to write with, even though no one was allowed that kind of thing in the concentration camp. And then after he had written this amazing piece of music for these other inmates, it was first performed in the concentration camp on borrowed instruments, instruments that were, again, kind of smuggled into the camp by sympathetic guards. It's an amazing piece of music, Quartet for the End of Time. It's not easy to listen to, but it has... There's joy in it, but it takes into account suffering, which is, I think, important. Here's a picture of the man. Another kind of classic example of art made in the midst of difficulty is, of course, our friend Vincent van Gogh, or Van Gogh, as the Dutch among us would say, created some of the most important masterpieces of the 20th century while he was suffering from terrible mental illness. Probably bipolar disease. He may have poisoned himself also by using lead white paint and not washing his hands properly. There are lots of speculation about his illness. But the stereotype of the artist painting in a frenzy or somehow being a bit crazy and hallucinatory and making these great paintings is not true at all. It's absolutely untrue. All you have to do is read Vincent van Gogh's letters, which are readily accessible in most major libraries. And he was thinking about every single painting he did. His journals are full of very careful thought. So they weren't painted in some kind of fit. They weren't painted when he was feeling depressed necessarily, although he was probably, towards the end there, he was probably depressed all the time. Or maybe some manic flights, you know, because there's a possibility they had bipolar. But the point is, he made art in spite of his mental illness, in the midst of his mental illness, not because of it. T.S. Eliot wrote his magnum opus, undeniably his greatest work, Four Quartets, during World War II. In fact, probably the most important of the four poems, Little Gidding, was written while the Blitz on London was taking place. The bombs were falling, and Eliot was working as a fire warden. Everybody was conscripted. And so picture this, okay? The bombs are falling. There's fires all over the city. People have fled, the children have been sent out into the countryside to stay with family or people that would house them. Eliot is there in the city as a fire warden trying to write down, you know, whatever was he could make of this craziness that was coming. He had already written The Wasteland and J. Alfred Prufrock and some of his more famous poems, and he was well acquainted with the problems of modernity and the enemy and the isolation and the fact that the war seemed to, this may be the end, you know, that was what they were facing, right? World War I was supposed to be the war that end all wars, and it didn't. So he writes in the final, the penultimate stanza of Little Gidding, he writes this. The dove descending breaks the air with flame of incandescent terror, of which the tongues declare the one discharge from sin and error, the only hope or else despair. Choice of pyre or pyre, to be redeemed from fire by fire. So, I mean, if you listen to the musicality of those words, you don't have to get everything that he's saying there, but the dove descending breaks the air with flame of incandescent terror of which the tongues declare. He's equating the falling of the bombs with the descent of the Holy Spirit.
This is the thing about the arts. They push us over the edge where words fall away. And even poetry, which ironically employs words, does the same thing. It takes us into that territory of feeling and thought and encounter where we lose control. Because our words are a form of control. Our numbers, our formulas, our definitions, our propositions, they're ways of holding on and comprehending. In fact, the word comprehend means to put your hands around. That has the same root. To get a handle on something is to comprehend it. But there's a lot that's incomprehensible. Vedran Smailovic, who is often called the cellist of Sarajevo, was playing while bombs were going off, playing Albinoni's music there out in the midst of ruined buildings. And so he became kind of an icon, a modern icon of this very thing that I'm trying to get at here, which is that beauty is for hard times. It's not a luxury item. It's a necessity. But if art and beauty are in fact relevant, as I think, to hard times, how can we find it? How do we seek it without resorting to stereotypes of the pretty, the sentimental? It's not that we reject what's pretty. It's just that that can't possibly encompass what we mean when we say beauty. Cam set it up this morning perfectly by asking the question, is this beautiful? And then showing us a bunch of images that we can't deny their beauty, like that crucifixion by Grunewald. You can't deny its beauty, but it's also horrific. This is where the arts push us over the edge into paradox, where we lose control. It's not about us. It's not about our control. It's about entering into having a true encounter with the beautiful, which is much, much bigger than our category of pretty. I mean, 20th century artists dealing with two world wars and countless social conflicts rejected beauty. Many of them rejected beauty. You know, these are some famous examples. You know, Guernica, Francis Bacon's Self-Portrait, Self-Portrait by Lucian Freud, Max Beckmann's painting Night, etc. And these artists seem to have explicitly rejected the beautiful. In fact, it's sort of summarized in this statement by Theodor Adorno: to write poems after Auschwitz is barbaric. Of course, I don't think Adorno meant that literally at all. I think, of course, you write poems after Auschwitz. But what he was saying is you don't write little ditties. You don't descend into the stereotypical and the ready-made and the formulaic when you're dealing with reality and you're dealing with suffering. So I'm going to look at three themes today, and they're pretty heavy duty, and I'm just going to breezily touch on them and then tell you a story. So the first one is incarnation, the idea that all art, all beauty is incarnate. It's embodied. There is no ethereal beauty that's disconnected from embodiment. Beauty, by definition, is incarnational. It's the creation. Secondly, hospitality, which may come as a kind of a surprise initially, but I'm convinced that beauty is only experienced communally. It can only be experienced by you being invited. That's why when we see something beautiful, we say, hey, come look at this. It's the first thing we do when we see something beautiful. We want to share it because you can't enjoy beauty by yourself. It's shared in a form which I hope to expand on a little bit here, of symbolic. And then finally, a phrase that came to me when the publisher had approached me originally for the book that I just came out of, that I wrote, and I gave it the title Unguarded Gaze. And they said, well, that's a bit obtuse. And they renamed it Makers by Nature, which I think is a fitting title for the book. But what I mean by an unguarded gaze is this costly simplicity that's at the heart of what I want to talk about here, which is letting down your guard and seeing the unity, seeing this costly simplicity. It comes from a phrase also from the very last stanza of Four Quartets by Eliot, and this is how this goes. So, you know, I see some people taking notes. Put down your pencils for a minute and just let this musical language fall on you. You don't have to understand it. This isn't about comprehension. Just receive it.
Okay.
With the drawing of this love and the voice of this calling, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, remembered gate, when the last of earth that's left to discover is that which was the beginning at the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick, now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded, and the crowned knot of fire and the rose are one. So you don't even have to understand what I just said. You got it. You felt it.
Right?
But that's what poetry does. That's what music does. Last night we listened to Mia perform this astonishing piece of music, which entered into our nervous system directly and changed us. So a little more about that theory in a minute, but before that, a quick story. So this is me, little baby in my daddy's arms. I want to say everyone is born an artist. Everyone, without exception, is born an artist. Some of us just never outgrow it. So here I am, I'm 3.5 years old. I'm in the backyard of our little cubicle of a house in Richmond, Virginia, and it's spring, and I'm in probably still in a diaper, but I have this physical reaction to something, and it's a carpet of these perfect little globes all over the backyard. And I'm absolutely overwhelmed. And I pick one of them, and I breathe on it, and it explodes. And at the middle of it is another perfect little globe. And it just burst into tears. And I'll never forget this. This is one of my earliest memories. Later on in life, I discovered that under an electron microscope, pollen, which we all sneeze at, looks like this. And through a telescope, looking in the other direction, the planets look like this. And so that early intuition, the reason I wept was for joy, because I realized I had seen the mind of God. I didn't have that kind of language. I didn't know words like transcendence. But I encountered transcendence in that little common wildflower, which could also be a planet, which could be a world. Those gossamer threads coming out to form a perfect sphere around another sphere. Spheres nested in spheres. So everyone's born an artist. Some don't outgrow it. I was not a particularly gifted artist as a kid. I got an award for being a good writer. But I was no prodigy. As you can see from these examples are the little spatter painting with a monogram and this invitation I made for my mom and dad to come to Mrs. Clark's sort of reception, fifth grade reception. I was not particularly proud of these drawings, but I loved making art, and that's what drove me. It was more love for making than any sense that I had some special talent. And I would wager there's a bunch of people in this room who, like me, just always feel better when you're making something, whether it's a loaf of bread or whether it's an oil painting. Because we were made to be makers. It's in our nature. We're not made to be consumers. You know, we're a consumer culture, and that's why we're so sick. If we could get over that and start making stuff again, I think our culture would heal. Anyway, my family was like most families, full of love, full of hurt. My older brother here in the tub with me, who I adored, got dosed with LSD-laced Kool-Aid at Woodstock and became psychotic and killed himself. These things happen in families. If we went around this room, we'd find lots of pain. But we also have lots of joy. There's lots of love. And so I want to just say, but I reacted badly. I left home when I was 17. managed to get away from all that, and joined a rock band, and played lead guitar and vocals. That's me.
Right there.
And I say I reacted badly because the right thing to do would be to stay and look after my parents, because when my brother committed suicide, it devastated them. But I needed to breathe, and so I left and found my way north. They were living in Atlanta at the time. I found my way north to Gloucester, Massachusetts. I could fit everything I owned in this little woody wagon, this Morris Minor, my very first car. I could fit everything I owned in that little car and still see out the back. That's the way of life, you know, that I wanted. I was very proud of the painting I did on the bass drum for our band. Our name changed every couple of weeks. This was Mothers of Insanity. But when I moved to Gloucester, the best thing that ever happened to me in my entire life, and that was meeting Meg. She was an art student at an art school nearby. I was working in a fish packing factory. You know, at that time, I'd gotten the first good job I could get, good paying job, sawing fish. And we were just kids. We got married a year later. She was 19, I was 20. We just celebrated our 51st wedding anniversary. And my son just celebrated his 50th birthday. So we were kids. And we made kids right away. So, like I said, my son beat us to our first wedding anniversary by about 2 weeks. So he's 50, my daughter's 45. She's an opera singer. You'll hear from her in a few minutes. Those are some great photographs my wife took. When after I was married and after we had kids, I did things backwards. I finally went to art college and started learning the skills, you know, all the typical things, drawing from the figure, doing endless self-portraits because it's a cheap model. So I'm going to show you a series of self-portraits here really quickly, and you'll see something happening. Can we kill the lights again? I don't think we really need the lights up here. Thanks. That's perfect. My first self-portrait was, you know, aiming at the highest degree of realism of which I was capable at the time. I wore this leather cap all the time because my part-time job was as a cab driver. And one of the fellow students said, "Bruce, why are you always wearing that silly-looking hat?" And my teacher stood right in front of me, the professor, and said, "He's wearing it because the visor cuts out the light, the glare, and he can judge the color relationship better." And I said, "Yeah, that's why I'm wearing that hat." So another self-portrait a year or two later, and trying to get a little more proficient, but also get a little more expressive. My first year in grad school, the influence of my mentors there, Philip Guston and James Weeks, was to loosen it up, Bruce. Loosen it up. So I started, you know, painting a little more loosely. And I think at that time what started happening is an interiority started emerging in the paintings. It wasn't just about the way things look, but how things feel, about where we live below the surface of the skin. That's what started coming out in the work. And you can see that in this progression where a loss of detail, but an increase of expressivity. And the paint itself, I don't know if I had a close-up, you'd see the paint in this painting is very thick and very brushy, and it was done very quickly. And actually, speaking of paint and texture, that same year in grad school, not only did I loosen it up, but I started using a different medium, which was hot wax and pure pigments mixed together. And it would congeal the minute it would hit the surface. You could build up the surface and you could get a very expressive effect. And that's what I discovered in this other self-portrait I did, where it's more, it really is just an internal self-portrait. And it was the first painting I ever gave a title to. It's kind of a pretentious title, isn't it?
Painter.
But I think that's what I was after. I was trying to get at something other than just the appearance of things. And so that during grad school, I loosened up a lot. Those little encaustic paintings, the hot wax method, led to some big paintings. They were the encaustic paintings like this one, about 14 inches square. Dream energy coming through these things, I think. This cat figure with a saxophone kept showing up in these paintings. Very influenced by German expressionists, the French painter Georges Rouault, people like that. But these little tiny paintings that are only about that big gave birth to colossal paintings, you know, taller than, bigger than I am, bigger than my arm span. And it was these paintings that won me the exhibition prize of the MFA program I was in at Boston University that sent my wife and myself and our two children to Italy for a year, all expenses paid. It was a pretty amazing gift. And it was money that was donated by Philip Guston, my mentor. He didn't know I was going to get it because it was given, the decision was given to an outside committee, who a jury that awarded me this. And I actually secretly thought that he didn't want me to get it. So I always felt a little guilty that I was using Phil's money to live it up in Italy, you know. When I got back, I continued, when we got back from Italy, I got my very first studio. This gives you a sense of the scale of the work. This was in a place called Dorchester, which is a kind of low, was at the time a low rent district in Boston. And another great photo by Meg. At that time, I was doing these, what I would only way to describe them is sort of psychological narratives. Those internal self-portraits gave way to these strange, dramatic, theatrical-looking images, very large paintings with titles like The Bribe, The World, The Flesh, and The Devil, Garden, as in Garden of Eden, but it's kind of a garden of discontent. But if you notice in both of the paintings, The Bribe and The World, The Flesh, and The Devil, The Temptation, the figure, kind of a self-portrait, I guess, holding a black book. There's a reason for that, because up to that point, I'd been following a guru from India named Meher Baba. I was involved in Eastern philosophy and Eastern mysticism and meditation and so forth. And Baba said to us, his disciples, if you want to follow me more perfectly, don't change your religion. If you're a Jew, become a good Jew. If you're a Hindu, become a good Hindu. If you're a Muslim, become a good Muslim. Go to the heart of your religious faith. Don't change your religion. And so I thought, well, I guess I'm a Christian. I was born into a family that was nominally Christian. So I said, what do Christians do? Christians read their Bible. So I started reading the Bible, and it made its way into my paintings, but it also shook me up, something terrible. It ought to be an X-rated book. And actually, I've got a new title for the Bible. Boy, am I nervy. Plan B. All right? How does that sound? That's what it was for me. Plan A never works out. So Plan B is, you know, Plan A would have been that Adam and Eve would live forever in joy and happiness and peace and shalom. It didn't go that way. What's Plan B? Jesus. Well, I became a Christian. I was 30 years old, gave my life to Christ. One of the guys sitting in this room knew me before that, and it was a tumultuous time. I almost lost my marriage because Meg said, I am not going to be married to a Bible maniac. The way she tells the story is that within 10 months, she had seen such a change in my attitude, in my character, that she was willing to even try coming to church. And then she ended up devoting her life to Christ. Both my children, independently of us, became Christians. But I naively assumed that because I was now a Christian, I had to go back to painting realistic art. And so I did. You know, painted a portrait of Meg, the bridge at the end of our street. And then, but one of my students, around this time I started teaching at Gordon, one of my students said, you know, Professor Herman, I think your earlier work was more interesting. Well, you know, I gave permission to my students to talk back. But anyway, I took that to heart and began trying to apply some of the expressionistic background that I'd had to my understanding of what it might mean to make images that might be fitting for Christians. So I made a series of paintings about Good Friday, which is coming up, folks, and rather dark paintings. Right around this time, in the 1990s, early 1990s, Meg and I were able to save up enough money from buying and selling houses that we fixed up, because I was a carpenter by trade at the time, before I got the job at Gordon teaching. So we were able to build our own house. I was quite proud of it. It was a very comfortable, very nice house. all open beams inside, etc. And within a couple of years, it was struck by lightning and burned down. You know what insurance companies call that? An act of God. You know, if a natural disaster is called an act of God, which was really interesting. The only thing that was left of the house was the smokestack, the fireplace, because it was made for fire. Redeemed from fire, by fire. And my entire library of about 2,000 volumes was absolutely cooked. It's a new definition of cooking the books. The only spine that you could read on any one of the books in my library was this one. And so my friend Eric held the lights while I took a photograph of it, and then I touched it and it turned to dust. It just absolutely crumbled to nothing. So something was holding those letters together on that spine of that book for me to see. We rebuilt that that winter. That was fall of 97. Winter of 98, 97, 98, we rebuilt. And this is this is what the house looks like today. Pretty much the same house. But it changed my work, and I started doing a bunch of very smoky-looking images. Lovers in a Dangerous Time. I saw Satan fall from heaven like lightning, prayer and distraction. I was also doing paintings that were very hot. The palette, very red, a lot of blazing colors. I did a whole series called Building in Ruins, which I thought of both as a building in ruins and also the act of building in the ruins. And among them was this painting, Elegy for Bonhoeffer, which I'm just going to show you a couple close-ups and then I'm going to close. You know the story, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was part of the plot to assassinate Hitler, even though he was a total pacifist. He violated his own conscience, he said, in order to do the right thing. When does that happen? Well, thankfully, rarely, but sometimes it does, where you have to do the right thing, and the right thing puts you in a very confusing situation. And he did it. He became part of it, and then he was found out, and he was executed. He was hung by the neck, but I could not picture painting a man, hanged man. So what I did was I suspended him upside down, or a figure upside down, descending into a field of pure gold leaf. It almost seemed to me, subjectively, when I did this painting, that the figure seemed to be dissolving, but also the Nazi death camp behind him was dissolving. So his life for the life of the world, his life to bring down the edifice of Nazism. Another one from that period entitled Called. I did a series of paintings on the Virgin Mary that I wanted to make her really seem like who I think she might have been rather than this sort of goddess figure. This painting, Betrothed, is a portrait of my daughter the night before she was married. It's a large painting, but also participates in that ruination that was in the earlier paintings. Another one from the life of the Virgin Mary entitled Overshadowed, which is the only time I have never seen a painting of her when she received the Christ into her womb. This is part of a triptych read right to left with the angel Gabriel coming and saying, you're going to give birth to the Messiah. She says, how can this be? I'm a virgin. She's a covered vessel. The overshadowing, I couldn't picture her being overshadowed. The angel said the Holy Spirit would overshadow you. I couldn't picture her being overshadowed by shadow because in God there is no darkness. So I surrounded her with gold leaf. And then she meets Elizabeth, who is pregnant with John the Baptist. This is from that same series, Second Adam, Magnificat. And here are some installation shots in Italy. It toured around the country, this body of work, most recently at a church in Virginia for about 6 months. Right now it's in wooden crates in my basement, which just seems strange. I love to do collaborations. I did a collaboration around Eliot's Four Quartets, which is why I've memorized a bunch of the poetry with Mako Fujimura, Chris Theophanidis, and Jeremy Begbie. Another collaboration with a poet and composer, Malcolm Guyton, Jack Redford, Ordinary Saints. And then this is what's in the studio right now. I started this a couple weeks ago. I am somehow returning to the place where I started and knowing it for the first time. This is the way I was painting in graduate school. I'll be honest, I don't really understand these paintings. I've just done them. They're very raw. I think they may have something to do with what's going on around us. A falling man, a drowning man, a family in tumult, maybe an immigrant family, maybe the Holy Family, a woman being tormented by a demonic figure. This man drowning figure bears some kinship with these drawings that I've been doing. And I think those drawings have a kinship with Kata Kulvitz, whose image I started with. She was painting between the wars, drawing between the wars. So back to the theory just for another 2 minutes. I think I've almost overstayed my welcome here. So embodiment, beauty is only encountered when it's embodied. It's only shared. It's only encountered when it's shared, when there's hospitality, when there's welcome, when there's a sharing of people. And then it's only encountered when we let down our guard, when we have an unguarded gaze. You can't encounter beauty if you don't let down your guard. And I would argue you can't encounter a work of art unless you let down your guard. You might bring your preconceptions to it. You might say, oh, I know where that belongs. I can categorize that piece. But you won't encounter the work itself unless you let down your guard. So I'll leave you with a couple of interesting quotes from Eliot. For most of us, there is only the unattended moment, the moment in and out of time, the distraction fit, lost in a shaft of sunlight, the wild time unseen, or the winter lightning, or the waterfall, or music heard so deeply that it's not heard at all, but you are the music while the music lasts. These are only hints and guesses. Hints followed by guesses, and the rest is prayer, observance, discipline, thought, and action. The hint, half guessed, the gift, half understood, is incarnation. It's from Four Quartets as well. In this quote from Hans Gadamer on hospitality, the symbol is the other fragment that has always been sought in order to complete and make whole our own fragmentary life. The meaning of art, in this sense, does not seem to me to need to be tied to special social conditions, such as was the meaning given to art in the later bourgeois religion of culture. The experience of the beautiful in art is the invocation of a potentially whole and holy order of things, wherever it may be found. And he's getting this idea of the symbol in hospitality from this old practice of Roman and Greek times of a little tile that was called a tile of welcome, a tessera hospitalis, about the size of your thumb in the form of a handshake. And you would break it when someone came to your house for the first time. And as they walked across a threshold, you would hand them a piece of that tile that had just been broken and say, henceforth, you and anyone with whom you share this piece of tile is welcome in my home. Only the two pieces must be fitted together. That's what a symbol was. Literally, it was a little tile of welcome. And it's come to mean all kinds of rich, nuanced things for us. But it's an act of hospitality. We make meaning together. But there's also an element of danger there. When you welcome a stranger across the threshold and you break something, you're enacting the danger of that moment, which is it may not turn out the way you expect if you invite angels to dine with you. That's what it says in Hebrews. Do not neglect to show hospitality, because some have entertained angels in doing so. And of course, referring back to Abraham and the oaks of Mamre. So that's hospitality. And then finally, an unguarded gaze, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded in the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one. The fire is the fire of divine love. The rose is the rose, the multifoliate rose of Dante, the Divine Comedy, which is the symbol of the church. And the fire and the rose are one. All shall be well. But it's a costly simplicity. Hans Urs von Balthasar, we no longer dare to believe in beauty, but make of it a mere appearance in order the more easily to dispose of it. Our situation today shows that beauty demands for itself at least as much courage and decision as do truth and goodness. She will not allow herself to be separated and banned from her two sisters without taking them along with herself in an act of mysterious vengeance. We can be sure that whoever sneers at the name beauty, as if she were an ornament of a bourgeois past, whether he admits it or not, can no longer pray and soon will no longer be able to love. Beauty is that important. As Prince Mishkin says in Dostoevsky's tale, The Idiot, beauty will save us. I talk about this more in my book, but I'm going to end with a song from my daughter.